Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
So, welcome to 11 Zizz with Danielle Perry, a podcast which highlights the importance of conversation through 11 questions over, of course, a brew. Throughout this series, each of my hand-picked guests will answer the same 11 questions as each other as we strive to explore subjects that normal promotional time limits probably would not allow. Today's guest is an absolute joy. I've met her twice very briefly at events in London, and I was so thrilled to get the email confirmation that she could join me today. So my guest today began working life as a teenage fashion model, but books and words were her first love. In 2003, she wrote Sunday Times bestseller, The Man with the Dancing Eyes, an illustrated novella, which she followed in 2007 with her first novel, Playing with the Grown-Ups. A devoted home cook, my guest has also written 2 cookery books, From Season to Season and Sunday Times bestseller Miss Dahl's Voluptuous Delights, in addition to writing and presenting 2 BBC primetime shows about food. She's a contributing editor at Condé Nast Traveller and was a longtime contributing editor of British Vogue. She's also written non-fiction essays for Yes Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Observer, The Guardian and The Times. She lives in the countryside with her husband, daughters, rescue dog, cat and tortoise. Madame Badoubida is her first book for children. Please welcome to the podcast, Sophie Dahl. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm fabulous, thank you. It's quite the introduction. And I was so pleased that you agreed to do this, because we've had very small meetings in the past and I just felt like I wanted to just chat to you more about stuff. So thank you.
I feel like we've had meetings in dark rooms. It's yes, always been very dark.
It has. But I've enjoyed it nonetheless. So do you have a brew?
I do. I'm slightly over-caffeinated. So I'm now doing a decaf builders.
Okay, perfect. That's exactly what I've got, actually. We are recording this in lockdown in 2020. So unfortunately, we're not in the same room, but technology allows this to continue. So how have you been coping with the lockdown? All right.
Yeah, I think we've been very lucky because we live in the country. So we've had access to our garden and walks nearby. And I think because my husband and I are both self-employed, we're bobbing along with the homeschool and kind of juggling it as best we can. But no, I think it hasn't felt like managing. It's felt at moments really wonderful, and then at other moments like we don't know at all what we're doing and and we long for everyone to go back to school.
We'll start with the 11 questions that we ask every single guest, and I find the fact that you've moved around so much throughout your childhood, please do correct me if I'm wrong as well, is it 10 schools, living in India, New York and London, 17 different homes?
17 houses, yeah.
I mean, my first question to my guests normally is, you know, what's your first memory? And I wondered where that might sit in that incredible adventure you had.
My first memory is actually quite pedestrian, I guess. And involves driving down to the seaside. My granny, my dad's mum, lived in Angmering on Sea, so not too far from you. And one of my earliest memories is being in the back of the car, in my car seat, and just the journey feeling like it took forever. And there was a petrol station that we would stop at that would mean we were about 15 minutes away, and we would always get a bag of fudge for my grandparents and I would be allowed a bit of fudge in the back. So my earliest memory is sort of sucking very happily on a piece of fudge in the back of the car, knowing that we were soon going to be there.
Oh, nice. And that is so reminiscent. I read one of your essays on your website about your grandmother and going down to near Littlehampton.
Yeah.
And spending time there. And I can really feel and see the parallels between that and the book, Madame Badoubida, because, of course, that's set by the coast, isn't it? The Mermaid Hotel. She always has a toffee, is it?
She always has it. And my grandmother always, she always had a toffee or a Cadbury's Eclair. She was one of those grandmothers that had sweets in pots. So there was always a Glacier Mint or a Cadbury's Eclair. And I think Madame Badoobadoo is a bit of an amalgam of both of my grandmothers. So I had a brilliantly eccentric American grandmother who had the world's deepest, deepest voice. And used to call everyone Divine One because she couldn't remember anyone's name. And then my dad's mum, who I call Gigi, was a chorus girl, ex-chorus girl dancer, and she was 5 foot. And so I was always a foot taller than her from when I was about nine. And I used to wear her shoes as a five-year-old. But yeah, the two of them, I think, are to be found in the character of Madame Badoobadoo, who I feel very fondly about.
It did remind me a bit of my grandmother, actually. She was always like dressed to the hilt, you know, full makeup, impeccable outfit, real costume jewellery, you know, so much makeup. I can't get over it now.
What was her name?
Vera.
Vera is such a good name.
Such a good name, isn't it? It really is. But yeah, no, it really did bring it to life. And I also read an article you wrote of your grandfather, Roald Dahl, and you were saying that, I believe it was this essay, because I've read quite a few, I love them, all about his red box that would come out after dinner if you'd eaten.
Oh, the chocolate box,
And there was always like a treat and there was always magic surrounding him.
Yeah, the red box was really, it was a Tupperware. It was a plastic Tupperware box, but it contained the essence of all magic when we were kids. So it used to come out after the meal was finished and it had those mini dime bars, chocolate buttons, dairy milk. Trying to think what else. There was always a Kit Kat in there. And you were allowed to dip into the red box after a meal. He was a chocolate obsessive. And
but didn't like the cream eggs, I believe.
Hated cream eggs. Yeah. Hated cream. Actually, I kind of hate cream eggs too.
Too much.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the granular. It's just the idea of egg and chocolate just doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
Easter's cancelled.
Forever.
There's a quote that I see on many things about you online. I don't know if you stand by it, whether it just really annoys you, but one that said that you described your childhood as an odd one, but with such magic. Is that fair to re-bring
that? Yeah, I'll keep it.
Yeah, you keep that one, because you never know, do you, when you read things. How was it moving around so much for you? Do you feel it was essential to who you are today? Because it must have had such an impact on you.
I think in many ways it was, because I think... it's interesting. My siblings and I have all stayed in the same place. I think that's probably what we got from it, that as children, we had such a nomadic time. And I think actually as adults, we've all been pretty secure. So... I would credit my childhood actually with giving us a sense of knowing how to lay down roots and seeing the importance of them.
Who's your best friend?
So I've got a couple of oldest friends. So I have Emily, who our mothers have been friends since they were 16.
Oh,
and
nice.
So I've known Emily since I was born, and our mothers were both... young jobbing actresses when we were little, and so they used to share a lot of childcare. I famously bit Emily when we were five because I thought I was the only person who knew the words to "When I Needed a Neighbor." Were you there? Were you there? And Emily announced that she sang it at her school, and then proceeded to sing it verbatim. And I was very, very angry. Clearly felt deep ownership of the hymn. Which is odd given that I'm an atheist, but felt a deep ownership of it and bit her and left. I think I drew blood.
That's one of the best stories I've ever heard, because it just took me back to school then, because it's quite accusatory, isn't it, that song, "Were You There, Were You There?"
It's so accusatory, and also it's so controversial because it also has, I was cold, I was naked. Were you there? Were you there? I remember thinking, well, why were you naked?
Why were you there?
Where were your clothes? What were you doing?
Oh, that is hilarious. Oh, that's so funny. And so nice. I've found as a mother now, like seeing my friendships, it's my birthday yesterday and just getting on the
Zoom happy call. Birthday.
Thanks, mate. But just getting on a call with my oldest friends. I mean, there's nothing like it, is there? And just sort of growing together and becoming mothers together. It's a very special thing.
Yeah. And I think just that language, the shorthand you have with people you've known for your whole life, or, you know, just that. When I was little, we moved to America, and I don't remember living in America because I moved when we were about three. And when I came back, apparently Emily and I met up in the country, and we hadn't seen each other for 2 years, and we took one look at each other and disappeared off into the fields for a couple of hours. And I really feel that instinctive thing that you can just pick up where you left off with my girlfriend.
Yeah, it's so, so special.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you're scared of? I wondered whether, and I didn't purposely put it in introduction because I didn't want to, you know, sort of the incredible legacy that your grandfather left in terms of children literature to define you in terms of this interview. But did you feel that weight on your shoulders when you were going to go and write children's books? Is there anything that scared you about that moment?
I think I've thought about that one a lot. And I think if I allowed that legacy to cow me, or if I took on the weight of that legacy, I wouldn't get out of bed.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know.
Do you know what I mean? I think it's one of those things that I've just had to have a sense of humor about. And, you know, I'm lucky that I'm a generation removed. I think he occupied such a space of his own. And I think the beauty of having him in my family is that actually above all, my family's language was the language of storytelling. And that's what that's the legacy I feel that I got, rather than a sort of legacy of like, oh God, I can't do this. I can't. It's more, oh no, that's how we all communicated. We told stories, and also through adversity, we told story. You know, I think it's a great tradition in families and cultures that how do you get through things? Mm. You make a good yarn of it, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Is there anything else alongside that you're scared of, maybe on a material level or like me? Like,
I'm quite scared of the lack of nuance that I think invades so much of interactions with people nowadays, the lack of discourse and the lack of I think there's a real lack of space for people to actually have conversations. I think there's so much shouting. Mm. And that frightens me that actually people don't have a chance to make mistakes and get things wrong. Mm. And I think that, you know, when we were young, there wasn't social media, there was the space to figure things out. And I think it's so much less so now. And I think that's frightening. I think a lack of discourse is really frightening.
Absolutely. And we're speaking now in a time where it's huge. I mean, there is so much going on. It's a heavy weight around the world right now with the tragic passing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matters protests around the world and the coronavirus. I mean, now I hope that people, they're saying they're going to have the conversation. I really hope that continues because it's essential, isn't it?
I think the thing is, I think in order to have the conversation, there also has to be, people have to be able to listen. And I think that's the biggest part of it is there's a great expression about having a strong spine and an open heart. So coming at something with a straight back and an open heart. And I think that just remaining curious and open and kind of being able to self-examine is the key to so much of it. And when I talk about nuance, I think, you know, what an amazing time this is in terms of these things coming to light and actually really having a forum and people having the conversation. And my hope is that the conversations keep on, you know, that it isn't a short-lived, that it isn't a short-lived thing.
This could be whether to do with your personal life or your professional life as well. But what's your ambition, Sophie?
I was thinking about that. I was looking at your questions earlier. I was thinking, do I have an ambition? I think just to carry on writing books and to lead a good life and to be a good enough parent. You know, it's quite simple, really. To be a good, curious person. How about you? What's your ambition?
Oh, it's never been pushed back on me. I suppose, I mean, I find like the older I get, the more content I feel, because I think you really get to know your own skin, don't you, in your own way, which is kind of in one of the questions wrapped up later. But this recent pandemic has really put a lot of things in perspective for me. The time at home, and I'm a Gemini, I'm a raging Gemini, so I crave adventure and I crave the beauty of a home as well. So I'm, you know, all over the place in terms of that. But I think really just sort of being true to myself, I think.
Yeah.
Just making sure that I'm listening and just not doing everything for everybody else. Making sure everyone's looked after, but making sure that I'm ticking the boxes that need to be ticked as well. It's quite a hard balance.
I think that's a good ambition.
But yeah, no one's throwing that back. Well, I'm prepared now for the next one. While we're talking about that, when you said like keep on writing, will you be working on a follow-up to Madame Badoubadar, or is there a new sort of direction?
So I've just written another book which isn't Madame Badoubadar related, is kids, and is probably a bit sillier.
When you say it gets sillier, is it quite thrilling to go, oh, I'm getting... You know, when the inspiration fires and the imagination sparkles, is it quite a thrill to go, we're going to go down this route? Or
it's quite thrilling for me. I don't know how thrilling it was for my publisher.
It's brilliant to read it. Oh, I'm excited. Oh, I can't wait to hear that.
And, I think my publisher were expecting a Madame Badoubadar 2.
Right.
More imminently. And I was like, well, I've written this other thing, you know.
Excellent. I can't wait. This feels a bit negative actually, but what do you think your worst quality is?
I asked my husband, and actually I wrote down what he said. So I'm gonna tell you. Because okay. I couldn't decide. Wanton outright rejection of all authority.
Oh, okay. That's direct and a confident answer, isn't it? Did you struggle with authoritative figures in your life when you were growing up, or people?
Yes,
people you didn't expect telling you what to do?
It wasn't as sort of clear as that. I think, again, maybe it was to do with moving a lot and just being placed in lots of quite unusual situations. You know, we lived in an ashram in India, and my mum took us out of school, and we then moved to an ashram in upstate New York. And there were many times that I saw things that people who were meant to know what they were doing, or who were meant to be in charge, make slightly questionable decisions. And so, yeah, I think I, as a result of that, I have a deep seated feeling around just questioning authority. It's interesting. Maybe my husband grew up very differently to me, and I sort of always ask, well, how do you know that? It's a very major difference between us, and it's something I'm getting better at, but certainly something I really had a problem with when I was a teenager.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I tend to really respect people that I do respect and really struggle with the majority of the others. If I find one person that I just think, oh, you are hugely inspiring, and I, you know, I kind of hang off every word. I'm there, but like, yeah.
But then there can be a problem with that, right? Because then you can sort of idealize people and put them on a pedestal, and then when they fall, you know, which inevitably they always do because they're human, then that's crushingly disappointing.
Yeah, it is. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, worst quality. It's probably interesting to ask someone that knows you well, isn't it?
Yeah.
To do that. If you could go back and give any advice to your younger self, what would that be?
It's really simple. It would be to trust my gut. I think, again, it goes back to those sort of, those feelings that one has. So say questioning authority, as a child or as a teenager, you don't really know. You just might know that something doesn't feel right. But I think there is so much to be said for trusting your gut feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you kind of try and, without meaning to pry into your family, do you try and install that into your children as well?
I think it's just good life advice. I think definitely good advice for your children, which is if something doesn't feel right, then really trust that feeling.
Yeah, totally.
And I think as women, often that is not something, certainly our generation, that's not something I remember ever being taught.
Just so liberating. It's one great thing about aging. You don't worry about those decisions after.
And I think you don't worry about offending people, because also that if you're just stating how you feel and not kind of putting it on someone else, or not, you know, that's how I feel, then it diffuses a lot. And I think, again, it's something we certainly weren't really taught how to do, but I think it's a good one. It's a good life lesson, that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. What's your greatest achievement to date, Sophie?
I would say my family. I really would. I think my family and family life. Had you asked me 3 days ago when I was chasing a baby blackbird that my cat had mauled, and calling my cat an arsehole in front of my children.
That would have been it. Speaking of which, you've got two rescue cats, a rescue dog and a tortoise. Is that correct at home?
That is correct, yes. And I had a blackbird for a couple of days.
Who has now flown the nest, I take it.
The blackbird went to the animal hospital. Where he's recovering from my cat's interaction with him. But there's normally a lot of different characters in the menagerie. So yes, we have a nearly 8-year-old tortoise, very neurotic rescue dog, and two quite murderous rescue kittens.
And did you just say 80-year-old tortoise?
Yeah.
Is that your brother's, did I read?
Yes, but he obviously lived many lives before us.
So, and also along those lines, a tortoise takes a pivotal role in Madame Badoobada as well.
Yes, yeah. Well, I complain about our tortoise a lot, but I'm actually secretly very fond of him. So yeah, it's the homage to Torty, who also has the world's most boring name. He was named by my brother, not me.
Oh, nice. I suppose a slow pace watching a tortoise is quite meditative in a way.
Torty is not meditative at all. He runs away often and spends a lot of his time trying to hump shoes. He's really gross.
Someone once said to me, the key to a happy home is to have animals and a piano. So you're sorted at yours, then, I guess.
Yeah, got it.
Got it all. Do you have any recurring dreams at all?
I do. I have a lot of dreams about being on a slightly melancholic island that doesn't exist in real life, where there's always a big storm going on. I'm always a bit sort of, there's always something happening there that involves tsunamis or hurricanes or is that. And then there's a lot of recurring doors and sort of Alice in Wonderland type, trying to fit through little doors.
Wow, fascinating. I wonder if you'd ever land somewhere on an island and feel like there was just a massive sense of deja vu.
It was the place. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
That would be really overwhelming, wouldn't it?
I don't think it's going to happen for a while. I don't think it's going to any islands.
That is true. So you've obviously done so many things in your life to date, but when was it that you most felt like you? You know, when was it that you were like, I know who I am.
I'd say sort of possibly boringly, probably now. I think this age has felt like the most liberating age in terms of I feel like I know who I am and I know what I want and I don't feel apologetic in the same way that maybe I did in my 20s. You know, it feels quite liberating. It feels like a real relief, actually.
Yeah.
I'm all for the 40s.
It's probably going to merge into the answer to this question then, which is, when were you at your happiest? Would you say that's now as well?
Yeah, I think it's now, but also just kind of hanging out with people I love. You know, I'm really happy by the seaside with my best friend and our kids and sitting on her balcony and having a drink and shooting the shit and, you know, kind of everyone running around. That's where I really feel at peace, I think.
So nice. No pressure on this one, because obviously your husband is a brilliant jazz musician as well, but is there a piece of art or music that's changed your life?
Well, again, I've thought about this before we spoke, and I think it's the song that we met because of. We met at a benefit for the Lavender Trust, where they invited women who were not singers, who were known for sort of doing other things, to sing. And I bizarrely agreed to be one of them. And Jamie accompanied me on the piano, and I sang "I Think It's Gonna Rain Today," by Nina Simone, but obviously written by Randy Newman. And so that song was instrumental in, I chose it because it's one of my favorite songs, and it ended up being the thing that introduced me to my husband. So, wow. Yeah,
that's quite emotional. That song must just have such... You know, whenever you hear it, I know there's a few that whenever they come on the radio, it's quite a cliche one for me, but Louis Armstrong's "What a Wonderful World."
Yeah, I know.
You know, that kind of record that reminds my grandmother and stuff. And I have to turn it up so loud when it comes on, like, you know, unexpectedly. And it's magic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is. So that, and then I was thinking about books rather than art, but... I love those. I've just started reading a lot of the School of Life books, Replacement for Religion, and there's an amazing one on relationships. And they're so, again, I wish they'd existed when I was a teenager, because they're so practical. I've been giving everyone, there's one called How to Overcome Your Childhood, and I've been giving it to everyone, and my husband keeps saying to me, you can't give it to everyone, they might be really offended.
I haven't read it, so I want to read it. I'll get it.
I'll just come round to your house and bring it. That's my current thing.
Fine, thank you.
I gave it to a very elderly woman who I don't know, and I think she was
she's probably like, I've been trying to do that my whole life. But thanks.
Brutally offended. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, amazing, amazing. That you must be really quite pleased to see, like with what's happening recently, everyone's sort of going back to their roots a bit more, spending more time in their garden, cooking more. People are going back to their bookshelves, aren't they? And they're sort of getting back into reading. And that's so important, isn't it? People saving, I mean, where I live, the library's packed, which is always just brilliant to see. But, you know, I think people are suddenly realizing the beauty and there's, you know, how important books, actual physical books.
I think it's that they're all of those things that I suppose we find solace and comfort in. I started baking up a story. I mean, like the rest of the universe, but just baking like mad the first sort of month or so of lockdown, and watching endless Tiger King, and then my husband sort of was endlessly wearing leopard print, so it all got very
very weird. Week three in lockdown.
Yeah. Cosplay at the Columns. Yeah. I was Carol Baskin and he was Joe Exotic. No, I think reading and cooking. I think you just it's I suppose reaching for those sort of hearthstones of family, you know, reading and cooking and gardening and feeling cemented in something where everything else feels in such limbo.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge comfort. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sophie.
Thank you for having me.
I'll probably see you in September in a darkened room somewhere.
I hope so.
Yeah.
We've got to see each other. We've got to see each other in the sunlight too.
Exactly. But I really appreciate your time. Thanks for taking a look.
Thanks so much, Danielle.
Thank you so much to Sophie Dahl. You know when you meet someone briefly and you know you get on but wonder when that could be? That was exactly what happened, really, when I met her. It was at the Mercury Music Prize live finale evening at the Hammersmith Apollo, where I was on the judging panel with her husband, Jamie Cullum, and she came to watch all the performances and the winner be announced. And we were laughing because I was fearing the worst the next day. I knew it was going to be a late night, and I promised my little girl, who turned 3 the next morning, that I'd take her to Peppa Pig World. So we were kind of laughing about that, and she was sharing stories about her escapades with her crew, and she was just really, really funny, real and gregarious. So I was so, so thrilled when she agreed to be on this podcast. Anyway, lovely to have her on. Look forward to sharing a wine with her soon. I have to tell you, her writing is wicked, if you haven't caught it yet. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And also, thank you so much for listening as ever. If you enjoyed it, I'd love you to subscribe to the series and rate, if you'd be so kind. It's all part of the process. Next week, we have Hollywood icon Jeff Goldblum joining me for a hot beverage and my next set of 11 questions. He is full of wit, witticisms, and wisdom.
I like this quote by George Bernard Shaw. Let me see if I can remember some of it. He says, "This is the true joy in life. Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion," he says, "that my life belongs to the whole community. And while I live, it's my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It's a sort of splendid torch that I've got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." That's what he says. So,
that's well remembered.
maybe I'd read that to my younger self and say, "Hey, get a load of this and keep that in your back pocket."
Until next week, thanks for listening.